Welcome to Product-Led Growth Leaders, where we learn about the bold path of building digital products that sell themselves. Let's listen to product leaders who can give us a glimpse into the innovative thinking process. Showcasing and celebrating these awesome folks, I'm your host, UX and product design veteran, Thomas Watkins. Welcome to Product-Led Growth Leaders. We've got a great guest for the show today, Therese Fessenden. Her background was as a web designer, and she became a web strategist, a social media strategist, and using design to help her business clients navigate their way to success. Today, she is Senior User Experience Specialist, Researcher Facilitator Consultant at Nielsen Norman Group, and host of the NNG Nielsen Norman Group's UX podcast. So we're very delighted to have her today. Therese, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me, Thomas. Yeah, excited to chat here today and share whatever I can to help.
Absolutely. Now, with this show, we rarely have designers on the show. I usually provide the design perspective. Here, this is important. You guys, biggest consulting firm, one of the biggest, at least in the world, from a UX perspective. And I want to talk about that as it overlaps with our normal topic of product-led growth. Okay, so start off by talking to the audience about why UX is still important for founders thinking about building the next great thing, or folks just managing projects. Why is it that UX is something you don't want to skip?
Yeah, so it's funny. I was just having this conversation recently, and we were thinking about the term user experience and how that term has gotten repurposed and misused in a lot of ways. A lot of times when you say the words user experience, the first thing that comes to mind is, oh, like digital experiences, which, I mean, yeah, that's been the medium that we've been designing for the last couple decades, right? But really, when we think about what a user experience is, it's well beyond what someone might see on a screen, right? It includes the thoughts that people have when they first have a problem, right? And they encounter a solution for the first time. It's what happens when their product stops working and someone needs assistance. It's what happens when someone's even thinking of canceling their plan or their subscription or whatnot. And people are starting to wonder now, like people call it lots of different things. Is it CX? Is it service design? And there are 50 million different nomenclature approaches to this. But at the end of the day, user experience is what people remember when they use a product. It's ultimately what they're paying for. And while they might be paying for lots of different things, what they remember is going to be a huge determinant in whether or not they're going to come back and whether they're going to stay a subscriber. And there's loads of studies out there about customer loyalty and, you know, how important UX is to customer loyalty and repeat purchases and revenue per visitor. No matter what metrics you use, having a good UX usually only helps those business metrics. So I think it's super relevant today. And I know that, especially with AI on the horizon, there's a lot of, oh, is UX dead because you can just generate your own interface? As far as we've seen, a lot of AI-generated content and things like that, it's fallen short because it all still stems from us needing to know who our user is. And so when I think of UX, that's what I think is like the most relevant. And why and how product teams can ultimately be better has a lot to do with how much you know about your users. So that's my stance on it. Happy to explore that more.
Yeah, no, that's great. Let's double click on the AI question a little bit. One of the funny experiences I've had recently teaching UX at the Rice Graduate School of Business, the students who are trained to be pragmatists, business students, for the final presentation, a few groups lately have been doing obviously AI generated screens. Now, I don't ask for people to be great designers. It's just a university class. And some people do wireframes, but then some it's like obvious AI stuff. And then I ask later, how did you create that? And a lot of times it's just ChatGPT. And then I kind of grade harder, by the way, if I can tell you've been using AI to make sure that you understand it. But the point I wanted to get to is that it can be very obvious, or it is very obvious once you start just looking at things for a few seconds, just peeling back the layers a little bit, you can get a set of screens that looks really polished. And the first second you say, wow, that is like a finished design. But then you start walking through it. There's all kinds of things that don't make sense. Has that been your experience?
Absolutely. And I know HBR, Harvard Business Review, just put out an article about work slop and how people being tempted to use AI generated content has basically led to this decline in overall workplace productivity because people are now fixing these super generic statements or super generic outputs. And it's actually taking people more time to get these productivity gains. And so while, like you're saying, at first glance, it's polished, it's great. What we've learned time and time again is, especially when it comes to the UX design process, is there's a pretty fundamental part that involves testing, right? Testing and getting feedback from users. And a common pitfall that I see a lot of designers falling into is the draw of the pixel perfect mockup, as opposed to the draw of having something that's more functionally high fidelity. So there's like visual fidelity, right? Which is what you get when you have these AI tools that are trained on a lot of finished interfaces. You get something that looks finished. But again, when you start peeling back the layers, you start realizing very quickly, oh, this doesn't have the functional foundation it needs to get any reasonably helpful feedback. So yes, absolutely. I'm seeing the same as you.
I want to see if you agree with this too. I want to pick your brain on this. It seems like what happens with technological advances, right, is the thing that used to be hard becomes easy. And then we get excited that the hard thing is now easy. But then there's this other area where the true value still lies. And so 10, 15 years ago, the hard part is, oh my God, I got to get into Sketch or Figma and then do the pixel perfect thing. And am I using the right colors and the right sizes of things? And that was extraordinarily hard. So it's tempting when we look at a tool that just generates it. It looks like it's doing all the work, but there's the other valuable piece, which is just thinking through it. Will it work?
Yeah, totally. And there's a lot of sayings that like a lot of design work is invisible. And some people think of it as the slaving away at pixels. Nobody sees you do it. Yeah, that's invisible. But the other part that's invisible is some of the what I call infrastructure work, which is thinking through workflows and thinking through user needs at various steps of the process. And that, like you're saying, that stuff is foundational, that hasn't really changed with the advent of new tools. And like you're saying, a lot of new tools have made some of these more mechanical, repetitive, time-intensive tasks, has made them a lot easier. And that's great. And that's amazing. And I think in some ways, the standard's a bit higher now because we have all this polish that we're capable of creating more quickly. But yeah, that foundational work is still there. It's still needed. And what I think we're seeing now is this creation of a new class of designer, which is maybe particularly skilled at what used to be very hard. And those skills are very desirable still, but there's a lot of an undervaluing of some of the more fundamental activities that make great products, that make better experiences on a deeper level. So totally agree.
By that new class of designer that you mentioned, I think I know what you mean, but spell that out for the audience.
So when I think of design, and actually this is great timing because we just put out an episode with Hang Zhu, who's known in the LinkedIn community for his hot takes. He's a design recruiter, former product designer turned design recruiter. And a lot of the things he talks about is his perspective from the recruiting side. And there is a huge push for people with visual design chops and craft and basically visual design taste. And some of that, it takes a lot of time to curate, right? But there's definitely a lot more emphasis on visual design skills than there used to be. And an assumption that you just happen to know all of those foundational skills that we mentioned, right? Like thinking of infrastructure, thinking about content, thinking about labeling and navigation and things like that. And so you won't often see a lot of these more foundational skills written out overtly on these job postings. Instead, you'll see a lot of, must have created or shipped products, must have built XYZ tool using certain tools, right? There's a lot more tool interest as well. But yeah, it's a different, I would say the result is now that we're creating a lot more people who are fixating on visual design craft, which ultimately is a good skill to have, but you don't want it at the absence of some of these other foundational skills, if that makes sense.
Yeah, from a consulting perspective, the way I like to approach it is have a team where someone is an awesome graphic designer on the team, and it frees up other folks to focus. Okay, I can focus on research. I don't have to make sure the personas are beautiful. I can validate them.
Yeah, and to add to that, the other thing that I'm seeing a lot of is with a lot of these UX budgets contracting, there's also a bit more of a push for people to do it all, right? To be this visual design expert. And also, when you actually read the description of these visual design roles, and it says designer as title, but then you suddenly see familiarity with quantitative and qualitative UX methods. And it's, wait a second, that's a researcher role. But yes, like you're saying, like ultimately, you're going to have a much stronger team if you can have strength in each of these or expertise in each of these areas, and they all come together with those strengths. But yes, I do think there is also a return to the UX generalist now, where if we can't afford to have an expert, then you have to know a little bit of all of it. And so it is interesting seeing some of those shifts as well.
Now, you mentioned the budgets out there contracting and just the economy the way it is, the industry looking at things the way they are. And you're part of one of the biggest UX consulting, oldest consulting firms around. But in a lot of folks, you talk to a lot of folks and you're connected with businesses. What do you think the landscape looks like out there from the perspective of new businesses? UX consultancies, what should UX consultancies be thinking about? What should the businesses who want it be thinking about? What are some of the things that you're seeing?
That's a really big question. So actually, really quick, what's funny about NNG is a lot of people think of us as being a massive like corporation, and we're like 30 people full time. We're actually not super huge, but thank you for the compliment. I do hope that our impact is outsized and is very large. And
Well,
we do.
I'm sorry, just to jump in for the audience so that to make sure that they understand, when UX folks want to find answers for things and they want to read articles, there's a couple of big areas, UX Planet, and there's a few others, but Nielsen Norman Group is the one I would say with the most prestige by far and is really important to designers. I don't know if the business world necessarily thinks of NNG first in all
Yeah, it
cases,
is
but.
interesting. Yeah, it is interesting. And I agree that a lot of UX folks do come to us, which is amazing. And it's always really cool to know that our work is having such a direct impact on like the actual design work that's being done. But to answer your question about businesses, we do have quite a bit of exposure to a lot of businesses. People come to us for private training, consulting as well. We do quite a bit of design reviews. We have a pretty broad range of as far as what we offer to other organizations. But what I can tell you, and it's hard to generalize because it is different from industry to industry, how UX mature your organization is, in other words, like how adopted are UX practices and things like that. But I guess as far as what I'm seeing budget-wise and what other teams should do to prepare, it, like I said, there is a contracting of budgets in some ways, but I think of it in two parts. There's kind of the bigger global economic factors, which we don't really have too much control over. And then the other side, which is how the work is valued and where we're prioritizing our spend on things like research, design work, shipping things and features. And I can somewhat speak to that in that, obviously, we talked a little bit about AI, and there's huge pushes to ship AI features quick. And even before AI, though, there was still this interest in shipping features quick, in being able to have a leg up over your competitor. And a common theme I have been seeing across many organizations is feature creep, which is in this desire to ship things quickly. We end up creating so many features or so many new changes that they're hard to manage and maintain. And it further makes it harder to do, again, that foundational work we talked about at the beginning. And so we start taking shortcuts. We're like, we know our customer. That's fine. We'll just hand wave everything and say that our past research is good enough. And to be fair, there are times when you should rely on past research instead of just redundantly making new studies. But increasingly, there is an awareness of this redundancy. And what we're seeing more of is teams that are doing things really well is they have a very organized and basically an intentional approach to how they do design and research. So some people call that design operations, some people call it research operations, right? But having a discipline or someone who is responsible for overseeing, hey, how are we doing design? How are we using research? Do we do research? What warrants even having a study done, right? Being able to ask those questions allows you to use whatever shrinking budgets you have really well. And so that's what I'm getting at is, sure, you can't always control how much budget you get, but you can control what you do with that budget. And so sometimes I see a lot of, woe is me, this economy sucks, and there's a recession coming, and I'm going to lose my job. And there are some things you can't control, but what we can control is how much impact we make with the budget we do have and how much we prioritize. So that's my words of encouragement, because I do know there's a lot of doom and gloom right now about the state of things. And again, AI doesn't always help with that. And in fact, I know Kate Moran, our VP, has been doing several talks over the last few weeks. And a lot of those talks are about AI features and how few people are adopting them, or maybe fewer than what people expected initially. So now we're facing this reckoning of, what do we do with all this money that we just spent on these features that nobody's using? So that's at least what I can say to budgets. And we can certainly dig deeper on that too.
Yeah, going to the AI features thing, right? You have companies, founders trying to impress investors, stakeholders, and throwing the word AI at everything. And we experience it in the tools we use, right? It'll be like, oh, use this new, it's like close. I'm not interested in that AI feature. And it's a simplistic summary thing or a chat bot. I'm not going to use that in this particular tool, because folks have to really think. And I think it goes back to putting the user first again. One of the terms that drives me crazy is AI first, or something like that. No, you're still making it for a user. Even if you're going to try to put AI into the features, you want to first think about, what's the value that I'm trying to add to the user? And then how can the UX, the AI help out with that?
Exactly. And totally, to say the word UI and AI is like synonymous, because that's really what we're providing. And I do think that in some ways we put the cart before the horse, where it's like AI is going to drive it and like it'll just bring value by being AI. And it's like, no, but you still have to think through what people need and then optimize for that. And to be fair, and I'm not going to claim to be an LLM expert or neural network expert, but I can at least tell you, from what we have learned about LLMs and how we have understood the back end of it, these are, as they often call them, non-deterministic models. And traditionally, user experiences have been deterministic. In other words, people come to you for a specific goal with a specific outcome in mind. And when you have a non-deterministic system doing that, then it's creating some degree of unpredictability, which makes sense why we have some mixed results when we are using some of these AI tools. But when we don't think through, okay, what are those determined needs that we know people have, then we're just adding even more unpredictability and lack of guidance. And so, yes, like you're saying, it does take more cognitive effort for people to figure out this non-deterministic tool and just manufacture a query that hopefully will be answered the way that they're hoping. So it is interesting seeing these shifts, and again, not seeing what is not shifted, which are some of these fundamental principles. So anyway, sometimes people will call Nielsen Norma Group fuddy-duddy, because like we're always beating the drum on these principles, but we have yet to be proven wrong, and we are open to being proven wrong. We'll even publish when we're proven wrong, but this is one of those principles that does seem to hold up very well over time.
One of the things I respect about your organization is that it's so truthful at times where something isn't popular. I remember when the iPad, I believe it was when the iPad first came out, and people were talking about, oh, it's so easy to use. They talked about how cats could use the iPad because they swipe there. And then you guys wrote an article that got a lot of people mad, especially the Apple fan base. And they didn't get the point. And the article is saying you have to have a task as the center before you can evaluate something as usable. And more recently, you guys wrote a superb article preempting the craze around AI users for testing. And
yes, synthetic
actually,
users.
Can you talk about that a little bit? Synthetic users.
Oh, synthetic users. Yeah. So it's interesting. When it first came out, it was interesting to see there were two ends of the spectrum. There were people who were super enthusiastic. We'll never have to do research again. We can just synthesize what people would think. And then the other side of the spectrum, like, this is the worst thing that could ever happen to user research. And we certainly had our own opinions of it at first. And then we said, okay, hold on. We have to actually do a study here. Like, let's actually compare. How does a synthetic user perform to next to a, several real users. Let's do a comparison. Let's see how good the generated responses are. And so credit to the research team. I didn't run that particular study. Let me make sure I'm quoting our researchers on that study correctly. But yes, that synthetic users article got a ton of attention because for obvious reasons, right? We started to talk about it, but more importantly, we confirmed what a lot of people suspected, which is that synthetic users are not going to be the most reliable source of information when you're making decisions on product, like specifically product design, business decisions, things like that. Main pushback, if I were to summarize some of the big takeaways, the main thing is synthetic users are prone to a lot of the same hallucinations and sycophancy as you might expect in a general generative AI tool. For example, I was using ChatGPT fairly recently, I would say definitely within the last month. So it's September 29th right now. And within the last month, I remember there was something, I was like sharing some ideas, trying to do some co-creation back and forth with ChatGPT. And it was just like, oh, something about this is like great vibes and just like lots of like compliments about my idea, which I didn't need in the moment, but I was like, yeah, great idea. And so anyway, I'm sharing that because when the synthetic users were generated, there would be questions that you would say you would ask a real person like, hey, did you do the study modules for your self-paced training or whatever? And a real human being would be like, no, I didn't do it this week. Like my kid got sick. I had work. I didn't get as much done as I wanted. This is what I got done. But then you ask a synthetic user and it's, yes, I value the importance of education. I did all the modules. I found this one very valuable. And so it gives this really unrealistic picture of what a real person does. And so it's dangerous in a way when you think about it. You're making business decisions based on a hallucination of what a human, a very happy, optimistic human would be making. And so anyway, so Maria Rosala and Kate Moran are the original authors of that research. And they really did due diligence. They compared and contrasted and wanted to give people a definitive answer on, can this be reliable? And unfortunately, it's not. However, there are cases where it could be beneficial as like a starting point, like very early discovery when you don't know anything at all. But again, when we say early discovery, it's like a great way to create a list of questions that you would ask real people, right? That's how I see it as like a reasonable use case. But I would not depend on it for product decisions because like we see that it's manufacturing this optimistic reality that might not be true. And if we're making decisions on that, it's going to be a really expensive mistake that we're going to have to pay even more to fix.
Yeah, absolutely. And when you read the article, it's so clear when you look at the conversation side by side, you're like, oh yeah, it's such a fake conversation. So Reese, what would you like to put on people's radars? You've got the podcast. What kind of things can people expect from the podcast? And what other things do you want to put on our radar?
Yeah, definitely. If you're up to listening to podcasts, which if you're here, you are, I'm thrilled to have another listener. So we do put out monthly episodes on the NNG UX podcast. We're interviewing lots of people. Some of them are coming from a product perspective. Some are researchers. We have service designers. We also talk about careers and things like that. So if you are interested in learning about what are people talking about, what's the current state of the industry, what are some common challenges, we're all about hot takes and challenging it. And so if you're interested in those sorts of things, we encourage you to listen. And otherwise, at the NN Group website, we're constantly putting out new articles, new research, new videos, and we have courses as well. So I do teach a number of those courses. They're either half day or full day. And our goal with these courses is to give people practical skills. Like one of the biggest gripes I have is as great as boot camps can be at introducing people to UX, they're largely theoretical and they're not often going to give you realistic information or working problems that you can take and immediately apply in a professional setting. And so that's always been a core tenet of the education work that we put out is giving people the ability to practice, right? To apply everything that we're learning to an actual outcome, right? So anyway, if you're into that, we encourage you to check out our full day courses, half day courses as well. And maybe I'll see you there. I hope I'll see you there.
Awesome. Totally. Therese Fessenden, everyone check her out. She's on LinkedIn and other social media.
Yes, I'm also on X and Blue Sky, but LinkedIn is probably the best place to go because that's where I'm putting all of the research that I tend to put out.
Awesome. Good stuff. Keep on killing it. Therese, thank you so much for joining us today.
All right. Thanks so much, Thomas.
Thank you for tuning in. Join us next time on Product-Led Growth Leaders. Take care.